Welcome to the Gooder Podcast, where we talk with powerhouse women in CPG about their journeys to success. This episode is sponsored by Retail Voodoo, a brand development firm guiding mission-driven consumer brands to attract new and passionate consumer base, crush their categories through growth and innovation, and magnify their social and environmental impact. If your brand is in need of brand positioning, package design, or marketing activation, we are here to help. You can find more information at www.retail-voodoo.com.
Hi, Diana Freich here. I'm the host of the Gooder Podcast, where I get to talk with the powerhouse women in the food, beverage, and wellness categories about their journeys to success and their insights on the industry. Thanks for joining us today. This episode is brought to you by Retail Voodoo. Retail Voodoo is a brand development firm. Our clients include Starbucks, Kind, RAI, PepsiCo, Hi-Key, and many other market leaders. We provide strategic brand and design services for those leading brands in food, wellness, and beverage. If your goal is to increase market share, drive growth, or disrupt the marketplace with new and innovative ideas, give us a call. You can find out more about Retail Voodoo at retail-voodoo.com. Well, thanks for joining us today. I'm very, very excited, and you'll hear why in just a moment, to introduce our guest today, Miss Jenny Costa. Did I say your last name correctly, Costa?
Nailed it. Yes, perfect.
Okay, great. Jenny is the CEO and founder of Ruby's in the Rubble. Those of you in the States may not know this brand yet, but you will hear in the moment. You're going to love them. Ruby's in the Rubble is UK's leading anti-food waste brand, known for making great tasting condiments using ingredients that would otherwise have gone to waste. Jenny started making her first batches of relishes from surplus vegetables and fruit, correct? In 2011, and since then has been working with farmers and producers across the country to put surplus fruits and vegetables to good use. For those of you in the US, like I said earlier, that may not have heard about this brand yet, you will. And I guaranteed it will be fun. The best part of me connecting with Jenny was their tagline, their strap line that I'd been seeing all over social media. And I had to reach out, which is around their brand being Gooder. Condiments, but Gooder, great tasting, good, fighting waste, Gooder. Brilliant. I just knew I had found a kindred sister. So I was so grateful that you decided to connect with me, Jenny. So very nice to have you on today.
Oh, no, great to be on. Thank you very much, Jenny.
Of course. And for those of us, well, all of us, everybody always asks, where are you located today?
I'm in London. I'm in our office in the heart of London. We've actually been in our office for most of the pandemic, which
really
is amazing for a small business. Yeah, we've been super on it with our sort of processes and trying to keep each other safe. But as a small business, it's been wonderful when you're firefighting the whole time and problem solving. To be in the same room is such a joy.
Agreed. We here in Washington State are a number of the businesses are starting to come more aggressively online, and big organizations are kind of struggling around the ethics of bringing everybody in, not bringing everybody in. And so I get it's more challenging when you're a large organization. When you're smaller, you can kind of have those fierce conversations with your whole entire team and come to some agreements that you can't win.
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty flexible. Most people are in the office 2 to 3 days. So it's sort of, I'm very aware lifestyles have changed. People have got dogs,
right. People
have moved out of town a bit. But I think everyone just loves being together and so really, really sort of cherishes that time as well.
I love it. Well, let's talk a little bit about Ruby's in the Rubble. Can you give us a history? How did it start and why does it exist?
Yeah, I'll go right back. So I suppose my background, I was brought up on a small farm on the west coast of Scotland in the least densely populated area in Britain. So I was very close to my family. My mother's an artist, my dad is a farmer, and we had a very, like, sustainability was the heart of my upbringing. We have water from a well that came off the hills in Scotland. We have wind turbines for our electricity. My mother was a very keen gardener and would pride herself on the fact that even in Scotland, we could sort of feed ourselves from her garden throughout the whole year, and she would always be preserving, freezing, pureeing fruit and veg, and anything that we had in abundance, she'd turn into a ketchup, a chutney, or anything like that. And anyway, that was my childhood. I then went off to university. I studied mathematics. I went to the city in London, and very soon after realized I didn't want to be there. Like, it wasn't, not that I actually really enjoyed my time there, but I wasn't passionate about it in any way. Mm-hmm. I kept thinking, if I'm here by the time I'm 40, I've been in this industry for the cash rather than being passionate to come. I was living for my weekends. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do something that I was, like, really excited to go into. So I was already exploring things, looking at new ideas. And then one night I read an article about bin divers and talking about people trying to break into the back of supermarket bins and taking food that was past its sell-by date, but perfectly good still. And I remember going home that night and I just kept on thinking about, why was there this imbalance? Like, why were we throwing away lots of food that was perfectly good? And then thinking about food in general, it's perishable, it's unpredictable. Mm-hmm. The supply of it, you know, farmers don't know what the weather's going to be like, it's mm-hmm. governed on the weather. And then on the other side of it, we have humans that we decide at 4 p.m. what we want to eat that night, and mm-hmm. we go to the supermarket and we want it in this abundance and beautiful presentation. And with it being perishable, when supply and demand didn't add up, what happens? And so that really got me thinking about it. And then I started researching food waste. And this was back in 2010, where especially in the UK, it was a really hippie notion, food waste. It was sort of a bin diver thing, a hippie sort of freeganism. But no one was really talking about it from an environmental point of view. And when you sort of, when I was realizing that agriculture is the single largest impact that we as humans have on our planet, from deforestation, from water usage, mm-hmm. from the carbon footprint of it, and we have plans to double our food supply by the 2050 to feed the expected 9 billion on the planet. But yet, currently, we're wasting a third of all food that we produce. But why is no one talking about it? And I, the more I researched, the more I read about it, I just couldn't believe that no one was talking about it. And it, mm-hmm. you know, if food waste and just the waste of it was a country, the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases globally. So it's a huge problem. So I then started going along and visiting wholesale fruit and veg markets, visiting large farmers and seeing fruit and veg being wasted on scale. And it was that moment, and I remember it's sort of 4 a.m. in a fruit and veg market and seeing Monge 2 beans coming in from Kenya, beautifully packaged, and they were destined for the tip. And I put masses into my rucksack and was going home, and I was like, this is just like my mum's vegetable garden. It's like, you know, there's just too much. And fruit and veg, those beans might not have a shelf life to sit in a warehouse, to go to a supermarket, yeah. sit on the supermarket shelf and into my house. But I know I can take a recipe. I can take these beans and turn them into something tomorrow or the next day that will preserve them, extend the shelf life, mm-hmm. and add value. So I took some of my mum's old recipes of relishes and chutneys and started from there, started selling it. I called it Rubies in the Rubble, a sort of play on diamonds in the dust, and seeing it as something so precious that was being thrown away. And thought, I just want to create a fun brand that raises awareness of this need to value food again and see it as a precious resource, but also one that is a practical solution to food waste.
Mm-hmm. Now, so I love this beginning, especially I always find it interesting. I'm sensing a theme here. I've met a lot of founder owners that are mathematicians, econ major, finance, moving in here. Like you use your superpower and are looking at it from a different perspective. I just absolutely love that. I believe, did I hear a term called freeganism? Did you say that?
Yeah.
Is that a term that is common? I love it. I'm gonna socialize it now. But
what is a UK term? I used to hang out when I was looking into it. I started reaching out to groups of freeganisms who would sort of
no way.
Yeah, and they'd live off of what was wasted or deemed waste, and they tried to not consume, and it was amazing to sort of see their values and understand why they were doing it as well.
My day can be done now. I learned something so big today. So when you're in the very beginning there, and you started socializing your idea, were you in farmers markets to begin with, or what were those early days like?
Yeah, so I was 25 at the time. I knew I'd got into something that I was super passionate about. Mm. And I had this dream already of just, I want this brand to be something that resonates with people. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to get it on supermarket shelves. I'd been brought up on chutneys and relishes. We never really had ketchups when we were growing up, or mainstream condiments. Mm. So for me, it was really normal to have a fruit chutney that on the table that would go with all salads and pies and anything that we had sort of every day. And then I initially made a load of batches, bought a very cheap market stall, and just started selling and just getting an idea of if people actually liked it. I collected different sized jars from the back of restaurants and got materials from different fashion houses as the labels. So the whole thing I wanted to be from what would otherwise be discarded. And very soon I used to sell them by weight on the market stalls, and then as soon as you start supplying some bigger retailers, had to scrap that and try and standardize it, make sure they were stackable. But yeah, I had a lot of fun with just getting into the markets, well, getting people's feedback, seeing what people thought, and especially at that time I realized, first and foremost, this product is something people consume, and so it's got to stand up for its taste. I don't believe that you can have all the will in the world or the biggest purpose, but if you don't perform on the main need that the consumer wants, you haven't got a sustainable business. So that's why they're buying into it, and hopefully it's a sort of cherry on the top that they fall in love with what you do. So I used to never tell the story on the back. I had one line that was just sort of waste not want not, and then just made sure that people loved it, and then slowly started introducing our story, and especially at that time there was a lot of raised eyebrows because people just assumed it was from the back, like from the back of bins, or they couldn't really understand the concept of food waste. It's been amazing being on this journey, and especially in the UK, it's become a very mainstream. I think it's now the main concern for a consumer buying food when they think about the food waste and the waste aspect. So yeah, it's been great being on that journey and just the educational side coming through. But it did also mean, from an educational point of view, is we pivoted from just being in chutneys and relishes, which is a very small market, to moving into ketchups and mayonnaises, so sort of more mainstream products. And we realized, if we can sell more mainstream products, you're going to have a bigger market share and make more impact from the fruit and veg stage as well.
Absolutely. What I find interesting, what I'm hearing from you, is your genesis was, when you were thinking about food waste from a food and veg standpoint, and you started packaging it up, you extended that idea conceptually to packaging by pulling recycled containers from everywhere. So it's like so incredibly embedded in your DNA. When you transitioned and you needed to standardize for retail, talk about that conversation. Was there consternation there? Did you have to find the right suppliers? How did you remedy that for yourself?
Yeah, it was a hard transition. So I started in my own kitchen, and then very quickly I wanted to be on the fruit and veg market. I was done with sort of getting up at 4 a.m. and going to see what there was. So I managed to get an old, they used to sell burger, like it was like a burger kitchen trailer, like a porta cabin. And I managed to get one of those and put it onto the fruit and veg market. And I converted it into my little chutney factory, and was based there. And at the time I had a girl sleeping on my sofa who was part of a soup kitchen that I'd been volunteering in. And so she was my first employee. And then she got some of her friends from the charity that she was part of, which was a homeless charity. And they all started coming and working in the kitchen. And we had this incredible sort of, we had Jamaicans and Hungarians and just this unbelievable mix in the kitchen. And so it was a really hard decision going from the small startup days, selling in market stores. And we had a little white van that we'd drive and drop off to all of our delis around London. And then suddenly food waste started to hit the headlines, and we got asked to come into Waitrose, which is one of the UK supermarkets, and pitch our products to them. And we also had Jamie Oliver, who the UK chef, who asked us to make a Piccalilli for his restaurants. And so we suddenly got this demand, and I realized in our little kitchen, I mean, on a good day, we'd be like, we got 150 jars out, and we needed to be able to really ramp up production. And it was a really hard call of whether we kept the model we had, which was so beautiful, or we scaled up. And I think when I pulled it all apart, there were so many bits of it that I loved, but right at the heart of it, my passion was around the food waste and raising awareness of that. And I wanted to make a huge impact in there. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, as long as that was the one thing that we always held on to, the rest of it, I didn't really mind, as long as it was done in the Understood. Right ethical way, how we grew. So from that moment on, we then found third-party manufacturers. We've worked with them for years now, 7 years. And they make our recipes. We've expanded our different ranges into all sorts of different things with various manufacturers as well. So our role as a business really now is sourcing ingredients. We then process it into a format that a manufacturer will want it. So it's an easy ingredient to accept into the manufacturing line. Mm-hmm. And then on the sales and the sort of brand side of things.
Mm. When did you know you were headed in the right direction? Was it a moment, or was it just a period of time?
I think most entrepreneurs probably do, that it's a quick journey. You hear of brands and you normally, by the time you've heard of them, they've done 10 years of building that brand, right? And you think it's a brand new thing. So I think it's probably good that as a founder you feel like, you know, I'm on the cusp of it the whole time. Otherwise you might not keep on ticking. But no, there's never been a moment where I was like, oh, I'm really on to things. I do remember the first time getting the supermarket call and thinking, wow, this is amazing that people love what we're doing and are coming to us. And I think that's been the wonderful thing with having a business that is led with purpose, that people really want to be a part of it, and they want to be part of the story. And they as long as the products, again, are like, you know, taste amazing and stand up in flavor and do everything else that a food product should do, there's a real interest for people to get behind it and to be part of that. So, I've never had the real eureka moment, but I do feel like we're still on that journey.
Sure.
Maybe when we hit the US.
Well, let's see if this is a really nice intro. Hey, on the flip side, and I always think these are the most powerful parts of the business. Of course, being a business owner myself, when I think back to those moments where something really went wrong, but it ended up being something that actually changed the trajectory of our business for the better. Do you have something like that that you can share, that you're like, yes, I look back at this, or this decision shows up in on a regular basis in my team now, we know how to do it? Anything like that?
I remember really in the early days, we got an order for, I had a banana ketchup, or it was a banana chutney at that time. Uh-huh. But it was, I always made it just at home to consume, and it was epic. I loved it. And we were pitching to a customer who was global, that they wanted a Christmas gift to send around to all of their top clients. We were pitching our normal range, but in my back of my bag, I had this banana chutney. And I, at the end of the meeting, I was like, you know, we also have, you know, I make this as well. And they tried it and they all fell in love with it. And they were like, this is so cool and so different. And it was on the 14th of December. They wanted it by the 18th of December. I'd never scaled the product. I'd never tried it in the kitchen. And I said yes to it. Went back to the kitchen, tried to scale it, and I just couldn't scale it. It was an absolute disaster. Anyway, by the time of the 18th of December, I knew the product was awful. But I felt the pressure of, they kept on emailing and wanting it for all their Christmas presents send out. And I packaged it up and sent it out. And I remember the whole time just thinking, like over Christmas, it was the most stressful Christmas. And I was imagining all these people around the globe opening up this awful, awful chutney. And I rang them on sort of Boxing Day. And I said, I'm so sorry that people opened it. Anyway, it was a complete disaster. But it's been a huge lesson. I think it will be from that time, we had then another customer and we were struggling to get something perfect. And instead of sending them something subnormal with our branding all over it, and potentially the first time someone's ever interacted with your brand, and it being a terrible experience, we then sort of said, I'm so sorry, we need to extend the date. And they were so, like, they loved it. They were just like, oh, great. I love how you're committed to making sure this is great. That was a huge learning, just like never put something out that you're not in love with your branding all over it, because it's detrimental. And then the other things, I think, I don't think anyone can say that they haven't had learnings in this last 2 years. We have had, I think we were 80% of the business was focused on restaurants pre-COVID. And so we had the awful sort of dreaded first summer of business just closing off overnight. But it's been amazing that I was always very hesitant of really going into retail properly, because I've always thought it was quite a scary place. I also think the bigger the retail is you get, you're a tiny brand on this huge big aisle, and especially the condiments aisle is almost like a graveyard aisle. It's like dead. And you're two little jars hidden amongst the sea of red. And I can't go there until the brand's bigger. But it's forced us to go in there. We pivoted, we changed manufacturers, we got into the right formats. And so far, it's been amazing success of jumping into a lot of the bigger supermarkets in the UK. It's forced us as a brand to grow up, and it's accelerated a lot of our growth. So, there's definitely been some things where I was like, oh, why was I holding back for so long? It's been good. Yeah.
Agreed. What is that, where this whole gooder component came from? Is it baked out of this last year? Did you just go, okay, to hell with it, we're going to double down on this and go big?
We've never really had a line that as a company felt tasty and appealing to the consumer, and something that you could get across quickly what we do in a couple of words, especially when you say fight food waste, people are like, oh, it's not going to taste good. And as well, I think as we looked at the brand and the more we do and the more things that we want to go into, it was just a sense of like not settling for. I think when I first started, I was like, the food industry and the food system is kind of broken, and let's not settle for that. Like, let's look for not just being a brand that creates nice products, but that goes above and beyond. We joined you as a kindred spirit of this amazing term, gooder.
Did you get any grief on it using the term improper English?
You know, I was the first person to be like, it's not even a word. I was quite sort of I couldn't get my head around it, and then my parents definitely were just like, "Gooders," just like, what is that? And now the more we did a big billboard campaign across London over the summer. And the more we've had it out there, people, I think, as you will know, just resonate and love it. And there's always going to be haters. I think that's a good thing in a way. It makes people question it or maybe even remember it.
That's what I ran into. I when I first started the Gooder podcast, it's been a year and a half now. I remember one person, for whatever reason, just felt like they needed to, you know, correct me. And I said, well, our expertise is in brand positioning. And I know that words can be sticky when strategically used. And the word Gooder has an intrinsic meaning. There's no confusion as to what Gooder is. It's, of course, bad language, bad grammar. And yet when you hear it, there's no confusion.
You know,
And this person just kept wanting to argue with me. And I was just, I finally was like, okay, I'm done with that. It's fun. It's a fun word. It's playful. I think in juxtaposition with the work that you're doing, it really makes the work that you're doing, as you said, not quite so serious and earnest,
exactly,
because there is an earnestness to the work that you're doing. But when you've got the earnestness of your work, and then you've got Rubies in the Rubble and Gooder, like, you now create this beautiful ecosystem that people can opt into. They don't feel weird about it. It feels like a little bit of a discovery. It's all very nicely done.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you're right that sort of the move into retail forced us to think, when you're on the shelf against everyone else, like, what is one word that can make you stand out for what you stand for, rather than history or you know, quality or whatever it is.
I love it. So do you have I'm curious, it seems like a lot of people that I've talked to, a lot of entrepreneurs, actually leaders in general, regardless, this last year seems to be filled with actually some moments of pride, things that would not have happened had the pandemic not shown its ugly head. Do you have a moment where you're like, this is great, I'm so excited, just a proudful moment?
Yeah, I mean, for us, definitely the pivot, because it was so much work in the manufacturing side of things, pivoting when no one wants to sort of speak to you in COVID. I think the realization as well that from a team, we can still stay so close when everyone's going through things. So I think that's probably the proudest, that, you know, our team is incredibly close, and COVID definitely brought us closer, just in terms of the caring side of each other. And as everyone will have found, it brings your home life into, especially if you're doing stuff from home. So, it's been very good from a team side. I think our customers as well, right at the beginning of COVID, we were reaching out to everyone when a lot of the chefs and restaurant groups were down and had nothing to do, and just, you know, seeing what we can do to help out. We gave out a lot of free products, and just getting our relationships really strong and joining each other in this kind of crazy, horrible time. There was nothing huge that was sort of like that moment, but there's definitely a lot of learning from this time.
Now, there were a couple of things that we talked about when we were preparing for this phone call. One of the things that we talked about was the use of buzzwords in our industry and a complicated decision journey, I think probably for brands, but primarily for customers. And you were really intent on wanting to simplify that. And in my notes, I don't have the exact details, but perhaps you can share your thoughts on that a little bit further, if you might remember.
I'm trying to remember what it was, but I think I think from a consumer, it's very confusing to know what you're buying into. I think so many brands, and us included, you're shouting so many different messages. There's so many accreditations that you can get as well. We were talking about the difference between Fair Trade and Rainforest Alliance, and you sort of see these symbols and you assume sort of a Rainforest Alliance, that must mean that the farmers get a good price from this cocoa. And actually, you don't really know, you know, there's so many stamps and things that are very confusing for the consumer.
Yeah, agreed.
And I think we were talking definitely about B Corp and how I think they're one body that has definitely tried in this mess to highlight and to give a new standard of the way businesses should run on and put their structure on, so it sits across vehicle look at five different areas of the business, and they give a standard of sort of these are the practices that you should be doing to be a business with profit and purpose sort of, aligned. And I think they're doing a really good job. I think it's just as long as it's really governed and continues to be really governed very well for the consumer to trust it and be able to buy into. But it's a crowded world with lots of different communication methods and lots of different shouting going out there that it's hard. I think social media has been amazing. They're opening that up a little bit and getting close to brands. But when you're quick and you don't have much time, it is very difficult just to really know what a brand does or stands for.
Another thing that I absolutely agree with that. Our organization or our firm, Retail Voodoo, is also a B Corp, and I'm getting more involved with some of the leadership opportunities with the organization. And I would say the largest thing for me that I would love to see B Corp do, and I wonder what your thoughts are on this, is somehow get the message out to consumers, because I still feel like B Corp is very B2B centric. And I feel in order for B Corp to really make the impact that it wants to make, there needs to be a socialization at that consumer level. And yet, just like you're saying, there's 43 certifications out there already. I don't know, I'm making that number up, right? But how do we simplify that? How do we make it easy? Can they all play along? I'm not quite sure what that solution is.
Yeah, it's a really, in the UK, we've now got supermarkets which will promote B Corp products, it's a sort of only a handful of them, but it is a help in the way that people will understand a B Corp. I think the other hard thing with B Corp is probably that all sorts of businesses can become a B Corp. And from the outside, they might not look like they're, purposeful or that's at the heart of everything. But I think that's probably why it's quite hard for a consumer to really understand that. And so there's probably a lot of work needed in just getting it out there, getting more and more brands to sign up. And the more brands do sign up, the more people will recognize it against the fight and the noise of everything else around.
Yeah, it would be great if B Corp could be table stakes, as I like to say it. Like, that's just the cost of entry of being a business and not needing the certification, but kind of an ethical set of standards of approach. But I think we're a bit of ways off from that sort of agreement across the globe. Another item that we talked about was food waste related. And I find this timing kind of interesting. I just released an episode with Regina Anderson of the Food Recovery Network here out of the United States. She's in Washington, D.C. I don't know if you've met them or worked with them. And she talked about how much food her organization recovers from the network to give to those that are in need. It's a complicated conversation, because I believe one of the things that you had mentioned to me was the cost, how much we spend on groceries now compared to before has allowed us to be able to buy anything and have this instant demand that you were talking about. And then on the flip side, we have so many in this world that go without. And I believe that you said it would be great if we could put a little bit more, make groceries have a little bit more value, cost a little bit more. But then if we do that, how many more people do we displace? How do we handle that tension? How do we handle that tension of doing good for the planet and doing good for everybody, not just those that can afford it?
Yeah, I think that's why anyone passionate and looking into food waste, especially, or the food system, it does feel incredibly broken that we are wasting such a vast amount of it, that so many people are going without in this generation. I mean, it's crazy to think that when we're, talking about we're so tech heavy, but yet some people have the lack of the most basic things. Mm-hmm. And how have we allowed that to happen in very developed cities and countries like my own and yours? And there is this sort of huge divide in that. And I think it's why when we look at this, it's got to be attacked and addressed from so many different areas. I think charities have got a place to play. And I think, you know, the food waste is such a huge issue that there's a lot of food that should go direct to charities and be distributed. But right at the very heart of the problem, of why are we why is there this food that's wasted already? And why can't people get food at the right price? And I think a lot of it is linked into, I mean, poverty is obviously one thing, education on like how to cook, facilities of how to cook. Do you have enough gas in your home to be able to turn the oven on? Have you been taught to cook from your generations to come? Or are you like reliant on fast foods or eating out? There's so many parts of it that are quite, you know, parts of the puzzle that I think from a charity's point of view and from the poverty side and the lack of food, I think there's a lot of things that need to be addressed, from education, housing, facilities, even having time. Like if you're a single mother and you're working hard and trying to have the time to actually cook a meal from scratch, which potentially is cheaper and potentially better for you as well than buying something ready-made or from a fast food joint. But then you don't know if your child's going to eat it, and so the safety of where you put your pound down is probably easier to buy fast food. Or so I think there's a whole, I mean, I'm being very generalistic,
of but course,
a huge sort of thing, the part that needs to be addressed. And and I think the area that we look at, where a lot of our customers are very wasteful in their own homes of they're affluent enough to be able to waste, and food has lost this value to it. It's natural, it's come from the earth, there's been so much energy, people involved in getting that out of the ground. And it was only two generations ago in war times where people would never waste. You'd utilize your leftovers,
never
a chicken, and you'd then make a secondary meal, you'd make soup, and it would go on, and you'd utilize every part of it. And part of that was probably have more time in our hands. The whole household typically didn't work. And we spent more money, like more portion of our income was spent on food. And so I think we're at a huge challenge. I mean, we see it in the UK compared to America. The relative cost of food is much cheaper than it is in America. And
really,
I think things are about to change with subsities, changing for farmers. But essentially the government have been paying for us to eat for years, and farmers can't exist without that cash, because cost of food is too low. So I think it's a really complex puzzle, and I don't think any organization or any one person has got an answer. It's got to be hit and attacked from so many different areas. But I think where I sit with a lot of our customers, I want them to get the value of food, and sometimes I feel like a lot of that is that, you know, perhaps if we're paying the right price for good food from farms and things, that we would value it a little bit more. Like I get flyers through my door for Domino's pizza, and it's a two pizzas for £20. And you think that's a really good deal, but then buying a chicken that was £20, you think that's really expensive. But that chicken, if you utilize it right, you're not just having one meal on a Saturday night, you're having your meal, your leftovers. And also that chicken is, you know, it's an animal, it's taken a long time to grow. I think that value on food is just really warped in our opinion, in our mindsets.
And it might be that even that it's systemic, there's a systemic approach to this. When I think about, I believe that you said that, you know, back in wartime, it was pretty common for people to spend anywhere of upwards of 40% of their income on food. And now we're down to around 10%. Is that right?
Something like that.
And so as I'm listening to you talk, I'm also thinking, well, what if we were to increase it and everybody was to spend 40% because that was the actual cost of the food? Perhaps there wouldn't be as many people who were needing assistance then, because we would be paying livable wages. So perhaps that's another way to look at that scenario as if we were, you know, because back then people could live on one income and the incomes were pretty hardy. And now it requires two incomes because everything's so cheap. And subsequently that cost needs to be pushed onto somewhere. It just doesn't evaporate. The need doesn't evaporate. So maybe there's a little bit of that, hey?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. I think going as much as sort of back up to 40% would be a real...
That'd be a shock to the
system. It'd be a real shock to the system. And there's amazing things that food becoming so affordable hasn't allowed us to, you know, we have, people travel a lot more. We've got more income to spend on technology and all sorts of things. But I think more and more humans are losing their connection with food. And I find that quite scary. I mean, food is the one thing that goes into your body. What you eat, you are what you eat. And we now see sort of food in white supermarkets and packages, and you have a complete disconnection that was once grown on a farm, and that was wheat, and it's been turned into a pizza, and packaged and on your doorstep. And so I think this sort of, without sounding too crazy, but for your soul as well, to like try and connect with nature again, food is almost our one connection in many places. And to try and open that up again is something that I think is really important.
Awesome. Well, so much to unpack here. Just, I love that your brand can inspire these kinds of conversations. And I'm hoping that even if there's one moment of thought in a consumer's mind, they could be thinking about this, and that the impact goes beyond just this amazing product and what you're able to produce through the system. But if we can have these incremental changes every time there's an engagement with your product, how great would that be? That would be wonderful.
It'd be awesome. Yeah. I actually think it's probably the most powerful part of our brand, hopefully, is the message that we hold with the products. Like I think it is a little reminder in your home. And yes, it's awesome that we're sort of reducing food waste from that side, but there's so many other organizations that do, and lots of amazing new practices as well to reduce food waste in the first place. But yeah, that's the bit that I get very excited about too.
Well, so tell us, what's next for Rubies in the Rebel?
So we I'm always getting told that I've got to concentrate. I've done pasta sauces, we did soups for a bit, we did smoothies for a little bit, and everyone's like, no, we've now spent a year and a half developing a ketchup that we are incredibly proud of. We do blind taste tests against the nation's favorites, and we sort of make sure that it tastes amazing, but it's got half a sugar, it's got pears. So we made a pear concentrate that goes in. You wouldn't know it, I don't think. And we always challenge people to try and taste the secret ingredient. But our main focus is just to get that into as many people's households and make a real impact on that. So we're sort of saying, watch out, big guys. Like we really feel like that area hasn't been challenged for a long time. We'd love to come in and do something really interesting. Wonderful. So our focus is that ketchup.
Jenny, I'm really enjoying our conversation. We're kind of getting close to the end, and there's a few questions that I like to ask everybody. So I'm going to move on to those. Right. I love it when my guests share some sort of interesting fact or story about their category or their brand. I call it a happy hour tidbit, something I can take to my girlfriends and go, did you know that? I wonder if you have something like that you can share with our listeners today.
About the brand specifically.
Could be about your products or the industry. How many tomatoes you use a year, something fun like that.
Yes, I think thinking back to our banana ketchup that we were terrible at when we first launched and then perfected it over the years. But that product for us is a really fun and interesting one. Bananas are the most thrown away product in the fruit. Yeah, they're the most wasted fruit, because I think people are very particular whether they want it ripe or spotty or whatever. And also they come from very far to get to the UK, especially. They're gassed normally when they come over in the ships. And then when they arrive, they sort of self-ripen. And for us as well, bananas have a very bad, when they decompose, they let up methane gas as well. So they are not very bad for the environment. And they're very hard to get rid of. You can't get it from anaerobic digestion. Yeah, so that was the main reason why we were like, we have to do something with bananas. And our play on that was to take the classic mango chutney and to have a playful spin on something that could be used with a curry or an Indian. And actually now, sort of see a lot of people using it with a Caribbean sort of style.
Yes.
And we've created our banana ketchup. But yeah, that's been a really interesting product. And I think it's been a really good one from our side. And the learnings as our brand, because we always think we've got two challenges. Where's the demand for what are people going to buy? And also what can we utilize? Like what is what is wasted in volume? So yes, that's our funny, sort of our quirky, odd product that was really a brainchild of wanting to reduce banana waste.
That is absolutely fascinating. I'm going to guess that avocados are right behind bananas.
Avocados are very big. Yeah, I think actually a lot of the time they're picked so unripe that then they often rot on the way.
I'm sure of it. Although I'll tell you, if you get a chance, and I'm not sure if you would, because this would come from very far away, Hawaii started producing avocados completely different than what we've been able to get from Mexico, Central and South America, that have a longer shelf life. They stay in that sweet spot, that ripe sweet spot, for almost a week, if not a little bit longer. And they're huge. So they're quite expensive. They're 2 to 3 times the size of the smaller avocado, but you get twice as much flesh and you don't waste as much. So you buy one and you use one instead of buying three and using one. So I think it's
amazing.
Oh, yeah. They are so good. The fat content is it's so good. If you find it, it's a Hawaiian branded avocado. There's only one. If you get a chance, you've got to try it. It's really great.
I've got to find it.
Yes.
Amazing.
And they only grow in Hawaii, they have about 4 months on the shelf starting in spring. So that's the only time you can get them. Yeah. Okay, so quickly, I'm so sorry, I get excited about my avocados. Okay, are there any other women or rising stars out there in the industry or not that you would like to elevate or admire for the work that they're doing right now?
I think somebody that I think is doing a great job, Celia Poole, who runs a company called Dane. She does it's a reusable tampon. And it's amazing to see what they're doing in that space. But they're also a reusable applicator for a tampon.
Sure, understood.
So instead of having to have the plastic around it, with an organic tampon, they're also doing reusable sanitary pads. I just think they're doing it in a really interesting way that's very open, engaging. Really good comms around it. But I definitely took my hat to her.
And what brands or food trends do you have your eye on and why?
So food trends, I get very excited about the fermentation, pickles. I think it's really hit the US, and in the UK we're still a bit behind. That would be the thing that if I could, I'd have my eye on to really try and ramp up that area. In the UK it's a really dead area in the supermarket.
Really?
Pickled eggs and some pickled vegetables and I'd love to do some really funky flavors and be very playful in those areas from a health point of view, but also from a fermentation and preserving point of view as well.
Well, I love it. Fermentation. There's a several brands that are starting to get some traction out here in the US that are playing with vegetables, but it's very, they're the types of products are, the number of products, I should say, the SKUs that they have are growing exponentially. So it's becoming, I think, with the influence here in the US of, we're getting a larger interest in wider palettes. The US is finally now starting to gain interest in North, Central, and Southern African cuisines and some of the outskirts of the Asian kind of recipes that go beyond this kind of standard American fare, so to speak. All of those, including, I want to even say the French tend to use a lot, and some of Central Europe uses a lot of the brined and those types of products. So it's interesting to see how the US is only just now exploring these types of products. And I would say for the UK too, from proximity standpoint, you're a drive from some of the countries that use these products on a regular basis in their recipes. So it'll be interesting to see where the shift goes. But I'll be part of your team and say, okay, Jenny, can stay focused, stay focused.
You're right.
Well, we have been speaking with Miss Jenny Costa, the founder and CEO of Rubies in the Rebel. Jenny, if people want to learn more about you or your brand, how would you like, where can they find you?
Please check out our website, rubiesintherebel.com. We're also on Instagram, on Twitter as Rubies in the Rebel as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we'd love to hear from you.
Wonderful, Jenny. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for what you're doing for the industry and for consumers. I really like a challenger brand, and you are a challenger brand in the big picture, and that you're challenging the way things exist, not just simply a product on shelf. So thank you for doing that work and sticking to your guns.
Thank you.
I'm excited to see what you tackle next. I'll be, now that we're officially sisters, I'm just going to have to say that.
Exactly.
So I'll be checking in on you every once in a while and seeing what's new.
Please do.
So thank you so much for your time. And I wish you a good evening, because I know it's coming on that time for you. And to everybody else, thanks for listening. And we'll catch you next time.
Wonderful. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to click subscribe and share with your network. Until next time, be well and do gooder.